Well, thank you for getting up so early, I guess, this morning to come out here. Now, I understand there are, I only recognize one person in the audience. So the rest are physicists, and I've got this talk in chunks, and so we don't have to go through all the chunks. So I'll start slowly and try and work through the material. If you have questions, please ask, and if things aren't clear, then we'll make them clear, and then we'll move on. I do, before beginning, want to acknowledge the folks who did the work. There's two lines of work in our lab. One asks, how does the brain select targets for eye movements? How does it choose where to look? And that work's been done primarily by Narcisse Bichot, Chenchal Rao, a new graduate student, Takashi Sato, and Kirk Thompson. And then the other line of work asks, how does the brain control when or even whether to make an eye movement? And it uses a paradigm referred to as countermanding, or a stop signal paradigm, that I'll tell you about. And that's been done now by Josh Brown, Doug Haynes, a new graduate student, Shige Ito, Veitch Duporn, and Tracy Taylor. So if we could turn on the slides then, please. Can you reach the power there? It's okay. It's right here. Okay, is there a pointer? I forgot. Oh yeah, a stick, good. That'll work. All right, this is the behavior. This will work. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I won't for a while. Oops. Wait, this guy. Let me just. Here we go. Okay, fine. Got it, thank you. Okay, here's the behavior that we're interested in. We've got a monkey, a macaque monkey, and we can equip them so that we can monitor where they're looking. And so we put them in front of a video display and show a blue spot and ask them to look at it. When they look at it, and the way this works is through methods of operant conditioning, the way you train your dog to roll over. Give them a reinforcement each time they're approximately correct, and refine the behavior through successive approximation until they are doing what you want them to do with enough regularity and enough endurance to get the kind of data that I'm going to show you. And so a blue spot appears on the screen, the monkey looks at it, and then this array of stimuli appears. One of them is different. There's a T and the rest are L's of different orientations. And the monkey has learned that to receive reinforcement of a squirt of juice, he has to fixate the T, all right? And it's a hard thing to do. It doesn't pop out immediately. And so in this trial, the monkey made an eye movement to the left, and then here, he fixates it, goes past it, and then comes back. Fixates it for, looks at it for a sufficient amount of time, it was 800 milliseconds, and then he got the juice. All right. So the data that's plotted here, each of these white dots is the location of gaze sampled every 4 milliseconds. And so where you see clouds of points, that is where fixation happens. That's where the eyes are still, they're not moving, and that's when vision happens. One of the fundamental properties of your visual system is that during the time that you're making saccadic eye movements, these rapid shifts of gaze around the world, you are effectively blind. You can convince yourself of this afterwards by going in the bathroom, look in the mirror, look at your left eye, and then look at your right eye, and then look at your left eye. And you will not be able to see yourself making the eye movement between the two fixations. You'll just see yourself looking at each eye. So vision happens when the eyes are still. One of the questions we're interested in is, how does, for example, at this point in time, what events in the brain resulted in an eye movement to this location and not this one or any of the other potential targets in the scene? Okay, how is this selection process taking place? The other question is illustrated in the panel here, which shows the same data, the same eye movements, but now plotted as a function of time. And so we've got movements in the horizontal and the vertical axis. where the plot is flat, the eyes are still, not moving, and vision is happening. And this deflection right here is this leftward eye movement. And this down and to the right is this deflection in the horizontal and vertical channel. See how that works? And so if you inspect this middle panel, one sees that the amount of time spent fixating each element varies. This fixation is about 80 or 90 milliseconds, about 100 milliseconds, let's say. This fixation is longer, on almost 200 or 300 milliseconds. It's the same stimuli, these randomly oriented L's, that the animal is fixating, and yet the variability in the time of fixation is quite broad. Where does that variability come from? How does the brain control whether and when to move the eyes? Now, the way that we think about it is illustrated in this bottom panel. This is a point of view that goes back to the beginning of experimental psychology, really, about 100 years ago. The notion is that when confronted with a stimulus, different stages of processing take place. And so this panel shows the 200 millisecond interval preceding this first eye movement to the T. So we pick that saccade and blow up the time. When the fixation lands on this L, a perceptual stage of processing begins. It takes a while to get started, concludes, and does its job. And that job in this particular refined context is just to figure out what is where in the image. Where are the other elements? The other stage of processing is a response stage, which takes a while to get started. And when it runs to completion, the eyes move. So it prepares and executes the eye movement. And then the whole thing starts all over again. So we can imagine at least two stages of processing underlying this performance. And we must posit that there are at least two stages because there is not a direct linkage between the processing of the image and the execution of the eye movement. If there were, and it was, you know, there were not, you know, if there was this direct linkage, we would have a hard time explaining the variability of the timing of the eye movements. Furthermore, another behavior that if we have time at the end, we'll tell you, we can talk about, is this corrective behavior. So he fixates the T, he looks at it, but he doesn't see it, let's say. So he goes past it and then rapidly comes back. This is the first saccade to the T, goes past it and then rapidly comes back. That fixation duration is less than 100 milliseconds. The claim is the monkey made a mistake, said oops, and returned gaze back to the original target. And so how does the brain know what it's doing? How does it keep track of whether the performance it produces is what it meant to do? How does it identify and correct errors? So those are the fundamental questions that we're interested in. The data are monkeys shifting gaze to look for targets in images, and recordings from neurons in the brain. And so for the next few slides, I just want to introduce the part of the brain that we focus most of our attention on. It's an area called the frontal eye field. And I want to do that in the context of the whole network that makes the eyes move. So briefly, the eye with a muscle attached, and to make a saccade, a certain pattern of innervation is needed to produce the forces necessary to rotate the eyes, and these are very well understood. And it's produced by a network of neurons in the brainstem. This network gets two kinds of signals. Where to shift gaze, that is, which muscles to contract to rotate the eyes, and when to actually do it. And these two signals come from a structure called the superior colliculus, a structure called the frontal eye field, and perhaps also supplementary eye field, and I don't know if we want to go into any detail with this or not. Much is known about this circuit. I want to just put the work that we're doing in the context that it's a distributed network. I'm going to talk about frontal eye field, but many other areas are involved. Superior colliculus, the lateral intraparietal area, parietal cortex that you'll hear about tomorrow, as well as basal ganglia, and surely cerebellum as well.
Yeah.
About what?
How important is basal ganglia?
If you don't have basal ganglia, you have like Huntington's disease or Parkinson's disease. So they're, you know. Well, the story that we can tell is this. Work that Okahide Hikosaka did with Bob Wirtz many years ago, and others have shown too, that the substantia nigra, pars articulata, provides a tonic inhibition on the superior colliculus. So producing movements, not just eye movements, but any movement, is you know, sort of one part excitation, making the eye movement happen, and an equal part release of inhibition, allowing the movement to happen. And so the substantia nigra inhibits the superior colliculus prior to an eye movement. The substantia nigra activity is decreased, releasing the inhibition and allowing the eye movement. What makes it decrease? It's activation of the caudate, which is generally inhibitory on the substantia nigra. And the caudate, the part of the caudate that projects to the part of the substantia nigra that projects to the superior colliculus is innervated mainly by frontal eye field, in part by supplementary eye field. Richie, does LIP go to the head of the caudate?
Yeah.
A bit, so LIP's there too? Yeah. Yeah.
What's the difference between solid and dashed lines and where?
The connections from the superior colliculus to this where network, the neurons that burst that make the eyes move, are strongest from the superior colliculus. The projection from the frontal lobe, from supplementary eye field certainly, and frontal eye field as well, are less agreed on. They're certainly not as strong or as potent to the nucleus that makes the burst happen. The projections to the nucleus that seem to trigger the movement do seem more clear from the frontal lobe. So it's just an indication of the kind of strength there. Okay? All right. The frontal eye field was discovered over 100 years ago by experiments doing electrical stimulation of the cerebral cortex, showing that movements of the body could be produced by electrical stimulation of the brain, which was an amazing and profound discovery. And so this shows more recent data from Charlie Bruce and Mickey Goldberg. And so you're looking at a side view of the frontal lobe of a monkey brain. There are particular folds called sulci that describe the frontal lobe, the central sulcus, the arcuate sulcus, and the principal sulcus. In this front or rostral bank of the arcuate sulcus lies the frontal eye field. If one inserts a metal electrode in this bank and passes weak electric current, an eye movement is produced. If the electrode is here, an eye movement that's short is produced. If the electrode is moved, let's say here, a longer eye movement is produced. So you're looking at traces, again, samples of eye position, in this case, it's probably every 1,000 or every 1 millisecond. And on repeated trials, electrical stimulation produces a movement of the eyes in a very kind of regular mechanistic fashion.
Up, sideways, axis?
Yes, so the animal is fixating here. This is the vertical meridian and the horizontal. And so stimulation here makes the eyes go down and to the left a little bit. Stimulation here. And so the pattern that one sees is a progression from short to long eye movements as you go from what we call lateral or ventral to dorsal or medial. The representation of angle seems to be completely scattered in this part of the brain, or at least nobody's discovered any systematic mapping of the angle of the eye movements. All right? The frontal eye field... Yeah, sure. No, it seems to be that the direction and amplitude of the saccade is more or less fixed according to the location where the electrode is. If you use stronger current, you just increase the likelihood and maybe reduce the latency of the eye movement. If you increase the duration of the stimulation, if it's just a short pulse, one eye movement. Longer stimulation train, you get multiple eye movements, but all of more or less the same vector. All right, frontal eye field is out of... That's a little better. So the frontal eye field is comprised of a variety of neurons. Many labs who record there see many of the same types over and over again. And so these are the main cast of characters. What's shown here is data from tasks referred to as memory-guided saccades. And so the F represents the status of the fixation spot. When it's on, it's a white bar, and at this point it goes off, it disappears. And then the T represents the status of an eccentric target. So he fixates, and a target can appear at one location in the receptive field of the cell. And in this case, it just flashes briefly. So it's on and off, and the animal is fixating until the spot goes off, and then he has to shift gaze to the location where the target had been, just to remember. And a key point is that the time of the eye movement is separated from the time when the light appeared, and the eye movement is made in a situation where the target's no longer there. And so the field has agreed that if one sees activity associated with the eye movement under conditions like this, one can attribute it to the production of the eye movement and not some residual visual activity. And so one kind of neuron one sees is a transient visual response. The light appears, a few action potentials are produced, and then the neuron is silent. So it just responds to detect the event of the light coming on. Other neurons will show a transient response and then show delay activity during this waiting period, during the period when the animal is just sitting, waiting to make the eye movement, presumably remembering where the target is. And this kind of delay period activity has been observed in many other parts of the brain, the parietal cortex, other areas of the frontal lobe, basal ganglia, superior colliculus. It seems hard not to find it anymore. In fact, a recent report in, I think it was Science, reported some delay period activity even in primary visual cortex. So, and then another major kind of neuron, and this is probably the most common in the frontal eye field, has a visual response activity while the animal's waiting. And then, when he's told to make the eye movement, the activity grows. And then the eyes move, and then the firing rate goes down. So these are displays. I've been emphasizing the yellow plot of average firing rate. These individual tick marks are the times of occurrence of action potentials produced by the cell, and each row is a separate trial. And one samples this data with repeated presentations to because the activity of individual neurons is variable, and one wants to get an average value. The last kind of neuron is illustrated here. These neurons fire during fixation. All right? And so in this panel, we're plotting the activity relative to the time of fixation at zero. So the fixation spot has appeared, and the animal has shifted gaze to look at it. And the activity of the cell increases and grows. When he's given the signal to shift gaze, the activity starts to go down, and in the period when the eyes are actually moving, the activity is low. And so these neurons act, it appears, as something of a gate permitting the eye movement to happen. And neurons like this are observed in each of the major structures that are involved in making visually guided or memory guided saccades. The frontal eye field is always located in the tucked into the bank of the sulcus. Now, the way that it's mapped out, as I'm illustrating here, can vary from animal to animal, and the morphology of the sulcus can vary from animal to animal. So it's not like an insect or within the same species, different individuals of the same species. And it varies in the same way that, you know, like ears vary. If we look at all our ears in the room, everybody, you know, there's no question we all have ears, but some are rounder, some are pointed, you know. Okay, I wanted to emphasize again the map of the visual field in the frontal eye field in this part of the brain. This is a map of the amplitude of the eye movements produced by electrical stimulation, and it corresponds to a map of the visual field in the frontal cortex. And so in this study, neurons were recorded, receptive fields were mapped, and you can identify the size and eccentricity of this, how far out in the visual field, away from the fixation spot, the cell responds to light. And so the key point is, if recordings take place in this sort of lateral ventral zone, the receptive fields are small, especially if you're in the sulcus, and the eccentricity is close to the fovea. And then as the recordings take place further up the sulcus, the receptive fields get larger and move out in the visual field. Yeah?
But the receptive fields, are they ordered also according to the center? Because you said the saccade amplitude is just the amplitude that is orderly represented in the cortex, but not the angle.
Yeah.
What about the receptive field?
Amplitude is mapped, angle doesn't seem to be. Now, as one makes a penetration down this bank, are you familiar with the concept of columns in the cortex? So as the electron moves through the bank, one will see a fairly orderly progression of angle. And so it's easiest with electrical stimulation. You go in and the vocal saccade, let's say, here. And as you go deeper, it goes here. And then deeper, it goes here. And then deeper, it goes here. And then maybe it reverses. So it seems to be a regularity of progression. But there doesn't seem to be any global map. Okay, the frontal eye field is innervated by a lot of other parts of the cerebral cortex. And so this shows the results of an anatomical study that we did, and it conforms to what several other labs have reported. So the frontal eye field is located in this part of the frontal lobe, and these labels have evolved in the field of neuroanatomy to describe different parts of the brain. I don't think it's necessary to certainly deal with them today unless you want to. But the key point is that the frontal eye field is innervated by a large number of areas. Some of the areas, like this lateral intraparietal area in the parietal lobe, are identified with a parietal lobe stream of processing, referred to as the Ware system, right? And then areas in the temporal lobe have more to do with identifying the properties of objects. What color, what shape, and so on. And all of these areas project into the frontal eye field. There's a more elaborate story to tell here, but it depends on some other information about the way the visual system is organized. And all I want to make, the only point to make here is that the frontal eye field is receiving convergence from many visual areas. It's situated to sample the outcome of visual processing at a high level. And it gets information about where things are and what things are. What color, shape, motion, and so on. Now, another point to make, all this anatomical data can be organized in a variety of ways, and this is an image that's become something of a classic in the field that was developed by Dan Fellman and David Van Essen many years ago now. And so the idea is that vision starts in the retina, and that areas like the primary visual cortex, V1, receive direct input from the thalamic nuclei that get input from the retina. So that's the start of visual processing. But other areas are deeper into the system, more distant from the retina. Well, how distant? And so one can apply certain rules to the connectivity and decide on a particular hierarchy. And so the frontal eye field here is this many steps away from the retina and from primary visual cortex. Now, other investigators have demonstrated that this is one of many possible hierarchies. The rules are sort of indefinite and allow multiple kinds of organization. One of the dangers of this kind of representation, though, and I wanted to elaborate on this a little bit as one thinks about modeling the system. One sees images like this and thinks that the processing is sequential. One's tempted to think that the signals go to V1, get processed, the file gets transferred to V2, that does its job, and V2 then sends stuff to these areas, which do their thing, you know. And so, what happens in front of I field is later and is operating on a more elaborate, in some sense, representation of the image. Well, when we started doing the physiology, we were struck by how early cells in the frontal eye field were responding to light. And so we engaged in a collaborative study with a guy named Audie Leventhal, University of Utah, in anesthetized monkeys. We recorded from neurons in many parts of the visual system, from the lateral geniculate nucleus, which is the structure in the thalamus that gets direct input from the retina, and primary visual cortex and other areas referred to V3, MT, MST, here's frontal eye field, and areas V2 and V4. Again, I'm happy to describe what these designations mean in more detail, but I don't know that's really relevant. Just they're different parts of the brain that have to do with visual processing. In the LGN, we know that there are different parts of the nucleus that get inputs from different cells in the retina. Some are faster, and so we're looking at a cumulative plot of the latency of response to a stimulus that appears in the cell's receptive field. And so as time passes, 50% of the cells in the magnocellular layers of the LGN have responded after, I don't know, 30 milliseconds or so. And 50% of the parvo LGN cells have responded after 50 milliseconds, all right? Primary visual cortex is responding next, but one sees that these areas V3, MT, MST, and frontal eye field, which you recall were at different levels of the hierarchy, are responding at effectively the same time to a visual stimulus. In fact, if you look at the time at which 50% of the cells in frontal eye field, in the frontal lobe, have responded to light, something like 70 milliseconds, at that time, something like 25% of the cells in V1 have yet to respond to light. Okay? So the time of response varies across the brain. A single area, like primary visual cortex, responds to light. Single cells respond to light at different times. And there's pathways run through the system that can transmit these signals quickly all the way to the frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe can be activated at a time before other neurons in the earlier stages of the visual system have even seen the light. Yeah?
Can you just say a few words about how you define the onset of response to the
light? Yeah, so the literature had an analysis of the timing of modulation in individual spike trains. It was developed by Legendi and Salkman. And so we just adapted this and employed it in this method. So what it does is it says, an individual spike train is a Poisson process, and so here's the spike train, and you got, you know, 10 spikes. If they were really distributed in a random Poisson manner, the interspike intervals should have certain distribution properties. So then we work through the spike train and ask, well, given this pattern of spikes, would it have happened by chance? And if it wouldn't, then that's when the neuron started firing. Now, I can get you a copy of the paper if you'd like that describes this.
I've read it a long time ago.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I forgot exactly.
So in this, this is, the latency is determined each trial and then averaged across many trials for the cell. These visual responses are pretty regular, so it's, you know, any method you use, you're going to get about the same answer.
Yeah.
Well, okay, no. It's the latency to an optimal stimulus for the cell. When you do a study like this, you've got two horns of a dilemma, right? On the one hand, you can use the same stimulus for every cell The problem is many of the cells, certainly in the visual, in these early visual areas, are selective. They like certain orientations or colors, so you won't be using the best stimulus. And that's a problem. On the other hand, you can use an optimal stimulus for each cell, or one that makes it respond well, and then you get, but there's problems with that technique. So we chose to impale ourselves on the second horn.
Yeah, but the reason you need to get before, because of complied with this is the same, because you said by the time the patient came to one area and the other area, and
just yeah, that, well,
it was sort of not happening at the same time.
Yeah, well,
but of course, the time of things which don't happen on parallel.
Right. So if we do the, if we look at data that's collected under the conditions of the same stimulus, the times that we see and the time, I mean, the study I'm thinking of in particular is one by John Mansell, and other work by Jean Bouillet has so the times are all, I mean, there's not much difference in the distribution of times when you do it one way versus another. I mean, in to get John's, in the Mansell study, he had to use really powerful bright light to drive cells that were not, you know, the thing is, if you take an individual cell, let's say a cell in primary visual cortex that responds best to a vertical bar, if you present a non-optimal stimulus, the response is weaker and generally later as well. That's right. Well, the way to rationalize this, and there's a study paper in, I think it's in Neuro Report, that by Hilgertag and Malcolm Young and co-workers, where they tried to reconcile these data with the anatomical connections. And so if one applies the rule that what's the quickest route to an area, what's the shortest number of connections, the hierarchy can get reorganized to account for these data. And the other thing is, areas like MT, the middle temporal visual area, are innervated by neurons that are part of this magno system. If you don't follow me, then maybe it's not relevant, this just for the specialist, let's say. So the magno system goes to MT, so it's fast conducting, and MT projects directly to frontal eye field, so there's a path for rapid activation. And then V2 and V4 are part of this slower conducting pathway. Now, the other thing to acknowledge, though, is that these data were collected in an anesthetized animal, and so my colleagues who work in V4 suggest that it may be that some of the delay of the V4 and maybe the V2 data could be attributed to the anesthesia as well.
So V2 is not between V1 and V2?
It is in the original hierarchy. And we know V1 projects directly to V2 and then V2 to V3. However, there's a pathway from V1 to V3 as well. So the point of this exercise was, if you want to think about modeling the system, you don't want to get trapped into a view like this and sequence and.
Also, I thought the rationale behind the definition of this circuit. If from V1 we have axons 2, V2, and V3, and V2 and V3 are mutually connected, so what is the meaning of putting V3 above V2?
These authors' argument was that this was a coherent way of organizing the whole set of data, the relationships among many areas. The question you're asking is, or what I'm hearing is, what if you apply different rules? Or what if you apply the rule to many,
you know, the don't you put V3 and V2 at the same level, for example?
If you just think about V1, that's right. So there's several things going on here. Ultimately, I think you're right. Ultimately, the V2 and V3 end up in a common area. If you talk about shortest path, and that's what this latest paper is going to end up saying. In this original study by Fellman and Van Essen, one of the rules had to do with the pattern of connectivity, so projections that went from one area to this middle layer, layer 4, it's referred to, of the next area were referred to as feed forward, and projections from a higher order area back had different organization. So they apply this rule and try to find the most economical form. There were some prejudices, frankly, I think, going into this. They wanted to see a hierarchy, and so they were driven to kind of stretch it out in this way. It's a legitimate question, though. Okay, and then we did that. All that's preliminary. So let me tell you what I'm going to tell you and give you kind of this is the conclusion about one face of frontal eye field, all right? So frontal eye field, it's a visual structure, it's a visual area. Lots of cells, at least half or more are visually responsive. It's connected to more visual areas than just about any other part of the cerebral cortex. So it's got a visual face, and it's also got a motor face, right? It projects to the brainstem, makes the eyes move. So it's really at the conjunction of these two kinds of systems. Now, the visual side, this is a side view of a monkey brain, and the claim is that the frontal eye field doesn't represent the properties of stimuli so much as their relevance. The likelihood that this part of the image rather than that part is going to be a target for an eye movement. So the way we portray this is, imagine that we've got our monkey, or we got you, fixate here and find the target in this array. Red cross, green O, red O. Where's the target? And you don't know because each thing is unique relative to the rest. You have to have some knowledge, and I'll show you data from this later, that the monkey can look for the red X because he's been trained. Today it's red X day. And so some parts of the visual pathway respond selectively to different shapes of stimuli. And so what we're representing is neurons, the set of neurons responding to stimuli in this part of the image, this guy, this part of the image responding to this guy, and so on. And there's a cross set of cells and an O set of cells. And I don't think this is in focus enough to see. So the cross is circled here because it's across the circle here, and so on. And so this part of the brain tells you shape, let's say. And there's another part of the brain that does color, another pool of cells, some that can do motion, and so on. And all of these project and converge in frontal eye field. That's the anatomical fact. This looks like, in models of visual search or visual attention, the kind of organization that feeds into what's referred to as a salience map. And so in models of attention or visual search, the properties of the image have to be sorted out. And then these different, let's say, feature maps project to a map that in which the activation is proportional to how salient or how conspicuous or how important each part of the image is. And the highest part of the map is the target for the next gaze shift or the next shift of attention, all right? And the claim, at least to organize our thinking about this, is that the frontal eye field can instantiate that kind of saliency map. And so here is the activation of neurons in frontal eye field, points in the image that have elements that are similar to the target, same shape or same color, same shape or same color, have some activation. And a point in the image that has the element that doesn't resemble the target at all has the lowest activation. And the one point that has both the right shape and the right color to match this memory representation too has the most activation, and that's what leads to the eye movement or the shift of gaze or attention. Okay, so that's where we're going. And now maybe we can get there. All right. So most of the work that's been done in these visual motor areas, or at least the initial work, entailed having the animal fixate and present a single target at different locations around the visual field. If the target falls in the cell's receptive field, as indicated by this oval, the cell responds. If the target falls someplace else, the cell doesn't respond. There's a property of neurons in the visual system that they have limited windows, receptive fields on the world. Now, our question was, what happens if that target is presented with distractors so that on every trial a stimulus appears in the cell's receptive field? Sometimes it's a target, often it's a non-target or a distractor. And the animal's job is to shift gaze to the location of the target, wherever it may fall. So how does the brain tell the difference between a target and a distractor? And from our perspective, how do cells in frontal eye field tell the difference? We knew going in that the cells in frontal eye field innately aren't selective for color or shape or direction of motion. Presumably because they're getting so much convergence from the visual areas that are responding selectively to color, shape, and so on, that all that selectivity is just washed out. And so here is some of the first data to show this visual search work. And so again, it's a raster display. Each of the little tick marks is a time of occurrence of an action potential. These are trials. I mean, so you understand when the monkey's doing the tasks, he fixates, the target can appear at one of these eight locations in this condition. And the location varies randomly. And he looks at the target most of the time. I mean, this is real easy. It's like looking for the red, right, berry among the green leaves. I mean, it just pops out. And the location varies randomly. After the fact, with the computer, we can sort out the trials. These are the trials when the target appeared in the cell's receptive field, as indicated by this cartoon. These are trials when a distractor's appeared in the receptive field, and the animal shifted gaze elsewhere. The plots, well, and then this is the average firing rate, and average firing rate, and they're superimposed here. Zero in these plots is the time when the array came on, and these orange bars show the time when the gaze shift was initiated, the time when the eyes started to move. And with the computer, we sorted them by increasing latency. Why would it be variable, right? Remember, so the target or the array appears here. Sometimes he shifts gaze with a shorter, you know, after a shorter delay. Other times it's a longer delay. One of the fundamental questions we want to deal with is where does that delay come from? And we'll get there. So, how does a frontal eye field neuron tell the difference between a target and a distractor? Time zero, well, initially, you know, before the array comes on, there's no difference of activity, thank goodness. And then after the array comes on, immediately thereafter, nothing happens until the cell responds. You know, it does take time for the signal to get transmitted up there. And the initial response of the cell is balanced. It doesn't discriminate target from distractor. So, I mean, we've labeled the lines and you know what the label is, but if I showed you just the first 100 milliseconds or so of activity, where's the target? You don't know. And then as time passes, through a process we don't understand yet, the activity becomes different. If the stimulus in the cell's receptive field is the target, the activity is higher, it's maintained, or in some cases grows. And if the stimulus in the receptive field is a distractor, the activity decays or is suppressed. And then you've got a differential representation which is sufficient to say where in the image is the target, where to shift gaze. Okay, here, and then there was one there, yeah.
With respect to the four different types of neurons that we have, which probably would be the most common?
The saccade-related cells that fire predominantly in relation to the saccade make up 15 to 20% of the cells you encounter in recording. The visually responsive cells like this are the most common. You know, easily over half of the cells are visually responsive. And then of these, many have this saccade-related activity as well. I mean, an important point to make here is these recordings are being done in awake animals with metal electrodes that have certain sampling properties. And so they're going to respond best to action potentials produced by big neurons. And I mean, I don't know if this group has seen slides, histological slides of the cerebral cortex, but there's, you know, many cells packed together. Some are big, some are small. And the small neurons, especially the ones with sort of spherical fields, we probably don't see very commonly in these recordings. We know that there's a sampling bias when one does these recordings, so that big cells tend to be seen more frequently than small neurons. And so, we have to frankly acknowledge that we may not be seeing a lot of what's going on. There was one here, you know. Yeah. No delay. He can shift gaze as soon as he can or will.
Now, the sun rate is something like 50 hertz before time zero.
For this, yeah.
That's your unique position?
Yeah.
These are recordings from the human trial.
Well, it can vary. I mean, these funnel eye field cells tend to be most active for the task-related eye movement. In the intertrial interval, they tend to be less active. I mean, not uniformly, but many are. And well, this kind of cell would fire at this general rate, but our environment is not completely dark, so he's got the outline of the monitor, and so in the intertrial interval, visual stimuli can fall in the cell's receptive field. We haven't analyzed it very intensively in this set of data just because we weren't that interested in it yet. Do you have
I wonder what this means, this divergence.
Yeah.
Environment, which is really quite fine, right? That corresponds to something. In the context of the past or something.
Well, I can't show you data for this cell aligned on fixation or you know, to show you what happens before he fixates. We just haven't done that for this cell. In general, though, they have a certain kind of baseline firing rate. During fixation, there's a certain firing rate that seems idiosyncratic. Some cells have more, some cells have less. There, in some of the studies we've done, I mean, I didn't bring slides for this one, but in some of the work we've done, small differences in firing rate on the order of like one or two spike differences before the target appears are related to what eventually the monkey does. And I can talk more about that later, but I didn't load the slides. Let me get here and then I'll come. Yeah.
Two questions. First, response is not specific targets. So can you switch, so to say, targeting director and get the same?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm showing you red among green. If we did green among red for these, the activity would be the same. Now, I didn't load these slides too in the interest of time. We happened on a curious finding. In the early work, we were systematic, trained the monkeys to do red among green, green among red, you know, both pairs of the kinds of things we were doing, and found this effect, and, you know, it all made sense. And so then Kirk Thompson joined the lab and was anxious to get going, so he had his monkey trained to do red among green, and just didn't bother to do the, what I said, green among red. Now what happens, these monkeys don't automatically generalize. So he's learned to do red among green. You show him green among red, and the first thing he does is the first cut is to one of the red distractors, because that's the color he got rewarded for looking at. And we know, and you can train him past that, that's not a big deal. But what Kirk found was, as he started recording, half the cells in the frontal eye field were now selective, apparently, for color. So in these monkeys that were either specially or poorly trained, depending on how you look at it, half the cells showed an attenuated, strongly attenuated response to the distractor. I didn't load the slides. We don't understand how that happens and wish it didn't. Cause,
I have a second question.
Yeah.
The dynamics of the response very much resembles what happens with attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
So target seems, at least phenomenologically, it looks like as if you just attend to red or attend to color or something.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that? Is there any similar effect of the frontal eye field with attention?
Well, okay. We know from human psychophysics studies that when you're confronted with an array like this, your attention is automatically allocated to this oddball, to the singleton. excuse me, unless something else is going on. But in sort of the general default case, attention is automatically allocated. And we see that this happens automatically. Let me also, in answering that question, and I haven't... Well, I'm going to get out of sequence here, and I haven't forgotten there was a question over here too. This selection happens even if he doesn't shift gaze. So we can train the monkeys not to shift gaze, present the array, they just keep fixating, the array goes off, they get their juice. And so this shows another neuron in the case where he's making the eye movement, and so you get target and distractor difference. And when he's not making the eye movement, we still get the selection. So is he allocating attention? We would presume so. And so from a variety of lines of argument, and I can go into it in more detail, the strong claim I'd make today, at least for the sake of discussion, is that allocating attention amounts to this differential activity, and that's all. Now, I don't want to say it's only happening in frontal eye field. The same thing we know from some preliminary work by a guy named Martin Perret, the same pattern of activity happens in LIP that you'll hear about tomorrow. I'm sure it's going to happen in spirit colliculus as well. So it's distributed across the brain. Yeah, okay.
Is it possible that the color signal comes later than the other thing? Shape first?
Well, okay. I don't know about color and shape. One of the ideas is that this early response is this rapid sort of magno-dorsal stream detecting. You know, cells in MT are going to respond to this display. They respond to anything that flashes. So this early non-selective response may be the dorsal stream input. And then the late selection is ventral stream signal coming up that's selected. That's not a bad story to tell. I don't know that we have any evidence to disprove it, but I'm not sure we have any evidence in favor of it. We saw the same thing. In this early study, we used checkerboards of different spatial frequencies, same effect. I'll show you some data here in a bit where the search is being done for direction of motion. Same thing. So it's an interesting question. Do these different properties express themselves at different times? But so far, we haven't seen that. Okay, great questions. Is this making sense? Does this make sense to you? Okay, I mean, if, you know. All right. Now, I showed you the averages, and I wanted to, reiterate the fact that the firing rate of individual neurons is noisy or variable. And this is an interesting topic. And so this shows, it's actually the same cell you just saw. We're plotting the discharge rate on every single trial at, 5 millisecond intervals. And the blue squares are the trials when the target was in the receptive field, and the yellow circles are trials when the distractor's in the receptive field. So in this baseline period, you know, it's on average 50. Boy, sometimes it got up to 180. And sometimes it was zero. And as you know, that's just the way it is. And then the initial response, and then the activity sorts out or separates. Yeah?
I don't know if you do also some intracellular recording, but it would be interesting to see what if the tempo that would be saying it fires at 300 hertz. It's extremely high rate. And
yeah.
You know, can you, usually this kind is hard to distinguish between interneuron and principal cell, but some people can. So, are there interneuron? Because principal cell at 300 hertz is kind of something that usually you don't hear about.
Yeah, so A, we've not done any intracellular work. With the awake monkey, it's, you know, the yield is vanishingly low. It's a great question. Now, whether this is an interneuron or a pyramidal cell, I don't know. We, you know, in these early days, we weren't too concerned about like the shape of the action potential and so on. The problem is getting that kind of information. Things are so highly filtered because of the system we use to monitor eye movements introduces some noise that things are getting filtered quite a bit, and so wave shapes hard to trust or push hard.
But
say again? Okay, what we did was I didn't love this slide. We create a spike density function by convolving the spike train with a filter that looks like a postsynaptic potential. Okay? I don't know, are you familiar with this idea of spike density functions and running a Gaussian filter over a spike train to get a continuous function? and you know, Barry Richman and several others had used Gaussian functions. And when we started this, we did two, and then we were saying, well, what standard deviation should you use? You know, why do you do 8 or 10 or 15 or why change? And nobody had a real good answer. You know, the answer amounted to, well, it works. And so through some reasoning that goes into some other issues, it occurred to us that the best an action potential can ever hope to do is make a postsynaptic potential. And so we can describe what those look like, right? Kind of a little equation that has a certain growth time constant, decay time constant, and so that's what we've been using for some time now. So yeah, what's actually plotted there is the value of that spike density function. Agreed. We act as if they're all excitatory. It's easy to change, you know, tune the thing. If we had a hypothesis that we could test to say, well, what if these were different? It's not, in the back of my mind, it's something to do. It's just I can't get anybody interested in doing it because I'm not sure what question to really ask. As we go through this today, though, one of the issues that I'm going to stress is time. When do things happen? And of course, when they happen depends on how you measure them in this kind of situation. So that it's worth knowing. But we would not have, we don't have independent evidence of whether these are projection neurons or not. Yeah.
You see here is one spike there?
This is many trials. You know, I don't know. Well, I don't know. I had. Say again?
For each time being, you need to calculate the rate for each individual trial.
Yeah.
And so you get one dot per beam.
Yeah.
And you have many dots per beam because of many trials.
Many trials. One cell, many trials.
But where are the green trials on the left? Are they just overshadowed by the yellow?
Yeah, they're there. It's just, you know, when you make these slides, they. No, that's just a cut. They're all there. They're just under, you know, in just the practical problem of making the slide, the yellow dominates it. But so I mean, you've already seen we the way that we you know, you got to say, well, when did the activity become different? It becomes a question of criteria. And so we, in part, inspired by the work from Newsom's lab and some other stuff. We went to the business of making these receiver operator characteristic curves. So we're plotting at different points in time. We say, what's the proportion or what's the probability of the activity being greater than some criterion value for the trials when the target's in the receptive field as a function of the proportion of trials when the activity is greater than that criteria when the distract or when the target's out of the receptive field, all right? And the area under this curve is a measure of how reliable one could be deciding between these two alternatives. Do I need to go into this? Does this make sense? Yeah. Okay, so, you know, at 40 milliseconds at this point, the distributions overlap entirely, so you're at 50-50. You don't know where the target is. At 100, you're getting better, and out at 120, you'd be right about 90% of the time saying whether the target was in the receptive field or not. Now, we don't want to make the claim that this, you know, it's a major claim to say this is how the brain's making the decision. For us, for now, it's enough to use this as a way of measuring when activity becomes different. All right? Okay. And so, as you've already seen, I mean, this shows a plot of that area under the ROC as a function of time. Single cell, when he's moving his eyes, when he's not moving his eyes, the time of discrimination is about the same. You know, it's not measurably different. And so these neurons respond to select the target, or respond differentially to the target, whether or not the eyes move. One of the interpretations that we've been dealing with for several years after we made these reports, the idea among many is, well, the frontal eye field wasn't for moving the eyes, and so anything that you see in the frontal eye field is about making saccades. And so that's one of the reasons we did this experiment and some others that I'm going to show you, is that this selection of the target happens whether the eyes move or, as you'll see shortly, in spite of which direction the eyes move. So it's further evidence that there seems to be separate stages or separate processes happening. One that identifies where salient locations in the image are, and another that makes the eyes move. Okay, now, we published a study this year where we wanted to look at the reliability of these neurons. So given that they're variable across trials and across neurons, how many do you need to get a reliable signal? Because, you know, when you average, you get rid of noise, and so how much averaging do you need? And so the data I'm going to show you was collected in monkeys doing this conjunction search, and so he has to find, in this case, the red X and arrays that had four elements or six. This takes more time than this. And then we also did a feature search where he's looking for green among red or green among not so green. And this takes longer than this. It's harder than that, all right? So here's the... Here's what we did. I'll be interested in your reaction to this. This panel plots the activity on trials when the target was in the receptive field in yellow and when distractors were in the receptive field in blue. The solid line plots the activity on trials when it was a four-element array. This is conjunction search now. So it's a four-element array, and the dotted line is when it was a six-element array. The solid one separates here. The dotted one separates here. It's a little bit later. I told you it's harder. You know, you see it's harder to find the target among distractors when there's more distractors. Now, these are average firing rates, but you remember that there's variability from trial to trial. So what we did, this is work that Narcisse Bichot and Chen-Chao Rao did, was take the sample. We're going to sample a single cell and ask how many trials does it take to get a reliable signal, and then we're going to do the other sample from the set of individual cells. How many cells does it take to get a reliable signal? So to motivate this, let's just do individual trials. So take one trial, you get the set of all the trials that we recorded, and sample one trial when the target was in the receptive field, one trial when the green distractor was, one trial when the other distractor, one trial when the other, right? There's three. And then which, on this random draw, which position had more activity, whichever had more activity, that's where the target was said to be. And we know where the target was, and if they agree, then that counts to the good, and if they don't agree, that counts to the bad, right? And so we can do that for one trial, or we can do it for two trials, find them at, you know, just sum them up at, or average, or three or four or 50. And so what's shown here is a plot of sampling at time C, the time before which the neuron had discriminated the target, and as we add more trials to the sampling, we ask what's our percent of accurately locating the target, our likelihood of accurately locating the target. And at this point in time, you can add as many trials as you want, and you never find the target. Well, that's easy to understand because the neural activity hasn't discriminated yet. It's completely overlapping. So you're doing random draws of completely overlapping distributions. There's no signal there. But now let's go to time D. So at time D, the four-element array activity has discriminated target from distractor. But in the trials with six-element array, the discrimination hasn't happened yet. The solid circles here plot the fraction of trials, or the fraction of draws, in which the target was located correctly, as a function of adding number of trials, you know, to average out the noise. And the yellow bar here plots the value 95%. It was, you know, practically perfect. That was our criterion. And so with, I don't know, something like, how many is that? 10 or 12 trials? Adding 10 or 12 trials was sufficient to average out the noise and correctly locate the target. But for the four-element array, for the six-element, it wasn't. And then at time E, we've got the discrimination happening. And by time F, the difference of activity is so reliable that just a few trials is sufficient to reliably distinguish whether the target's in the receptive field or not. And so the number of trials to reach criterion is plotted here as a function of time. Until the discrimination takes place, there's no value. And then for the four-element array, at this point in time, you know, what do you call it, 15 trials or so was needed. And then as time passes, the discrimination becomes more reliable, so that ultimately just a few trials is all that's needed to locate the target. Yeah? This was, we did the spike density function, and I think this was a 10 millisecond bin of that time. Yeah, it's a narrow slice.
It's a narrow slice, so you
yeah.
can take all the history into account, you just take
that. No. Yeah.
So then how does it happen that at point F, you can just discriminate?
Yeah, because they're so different, right? All right. So once the discrimination has taken place, very few trials are needed to locate the target. And then if you do the same thing, this just shows the distribution from the conjunction surge 4 and 6 element. You know, in the asymptote for the 6 element array, it was 10. Trials needed, and for the 4 stimuli, it's, what is that, you know, 8 or 7 or something. And this target, the time at which this signal arose is later for the harder search. We'll have more to say about that later. Here's the same kind of data, though. Now, instead of taking individual trials from one cell, take trials from multiple neurons. So put the whole pool together and just randomly draw from them. And you can see the same form, and at asymptote, it's, you know, very few neurons needed to signal where the target is. Yeah.
Are these simultaneously recorded?
No. Well, some in the feature search were, and when we looked at those data, there wasn't much difference. But you're right, there is work where simultaneously recorded cells seem to signal more information than sequentially recorded cells. And that's something we want to get to. Well, I mean, it's not that it's completely invalid. It's just this is probably a lower bound, right? I mean, if there's correlation, then... Yeah. But we're impressed by the fact that in the limit anyway, you're down to, you know, clearly fewer than 100 cells. And on the order of, you know, around 10 or so. So, you know, it's one point of view on the data. And clearly there's more to be done. And simultaneous recordings are a key part of it. Okay. All right, so that's segment one. Now, well, I was going to say, we're now entering in kind of the next phase, so if you want to take a break now, this is a good... The top panel compares the activity when the target's in the receptive field or distractors are in the receptive field and the target didn't step. These are the kind of control thing, and by now hopefully you recognize what you're seeing. The next panel are going to compare what happens on trials when the distractor starts in the receptive field and then, unexpectedly, it becomes a target. Okay? We're going to compare trials when he makes the compensatory movement to the new location of the target with trials where there was no step and it remains a distractor. That's kind of the parallel condition. One of the ways in the lab that we think about this is, and I don't know if this is still legitimate in physics, the idea of parallel universes. So in one universe, the target stepped, and in the other universe, it didn't. And this compares what happens in those parallel universes. All right. The distractor is in the receptive field. You get this initial response, and then the activity decays, as we saw before. The pink shows the activity on trials where it starts as a distractor, so you have the initial response. The activity starts to go down. At this point, the distractor becomes a target, and after this delay, you see the activity start to grow, as it does when a target's in the receptive field. So it grows, and he shifts gaze to the target in the receptive field. This is just fine. This is what the neuron ought to do. If he compensates, the neuron ought to signal where the target is and make the eyes move. There's no real surprise here, given that he's performing correctly. What's interesting are trials where he fails to compensate. So the distractor's in the receptive field, it becomes a target, and the activity decays. On trials where it becomes a target, but he fails to compensate, so gaze shifts elsewhere, we see this activity start to grow anyway. All right, so there's a dissociation. The activity of this neuron is representing or responding to the location of the target, whether or not gaze shifts to it. The activity after this point is going to be dominated by this corrective saccade. And so when we were formulating this one, making these slides, we were emphasizing the activity before this target step reaction time, because that's the time at which modulation has to happen to make a difference. And so this cell is firing in this way, regardless of where gaze goes. So these visually responsive cells are representing the location of the target and not necessarily the location of the gaze shift. And this comes back to the question of the allocation of attention. We know that it's possible to shift attention covertly away from the point of fixation. It's effortful and costly. If you're going to shift gaze one way and shift attention another way, you're slower and less reliable than if you shift attention and gaze the same direction. But so this shows, again, it's consistent with the idea that these neurons can amount to the shift of attention without shifting gaze. All right, now, in the other kind of trial, and I'm just going to blast through this, what happens if the target becomes a distractor? Well, in some neurons, the activity goes down a little bit, but often not much happens, okay? I'm showing you this to say these visually responsive cells are not so interesting when the target becomes a distractor. If anything, they're a little less active, but most of the cells didn't modulate very much in this particular kind of trial. Contrast that with the other kind of neuron in frontal eye field, the movement-related neurons. And so now, this is another kind of neuron that's not got much, if any, of a visual response. The activity is dominated by growth of activity preceding the eye movement. All right? And let me just say also, we know these neurons tend to be cells in layer 5 that send their axons to the superior colliculus in the brainstem to make the eyes move from work in other labs. All right, when the target becomes a distractor and he looks elsewhere, he compensates, he shouldn't make the eye movement into the movement field or receptive field of the cell. So now we're going to compare trials where the target's in the receptive field and it remains there in yellow, and the pink now shows trials where he cancels the eye movement that this neuron was going to make another one. And we see the activity starting to grow, and then it stops and decays. And it does so before this target step reaction time. So it's within the interval necessary to prevent the unwanted eye movement and allow the correct eye movement. if the on trials where he fails to compensate, so he makes an eye movement that he shouldn't have made into this, that this cell is responsible for, the activity is the same as if he made the eye movement in spite of, or if there was no step. Okay? So we've got one class of neurons that's signaling the location of the target regardless of where the eyes move, and another class of neuron that fires in a way appropriate to control whether or not the eyes move in, you know, into the movement field of that cell. And then finally, we can look at these movement neurons in the converse condition. So now the distractor becomes a target. So this is now putting the neuron in the condition where it's going to make the compensated eye movement. And so if the distractor is in the receptive field and it remains a distractor, there's no modulation. That's shown in blue. If the distractor becomes a target and the animal succeeds in compensating, we see the activity is low, and then after this target step reaction time, after this movement, the other movement was canceled, this activity starts to grow and makes the eye movement. And if he fails to compensate, there's no growth of activity. So I want to try to persuade you that we've got two kinds of neurons, at least two, in the frontal eye field that are signaling different things, doing different things for the performance of this task. Yeah?
The second kind is mostly layered by the neurons.
Yes.
The first kind is all over?
Well, okay. Before a year or two ago, the story was that the strongly visually responsive cells were not the projection neurons to colliculus and brainstem. That was based on work by Mark Seagraves with Mickey Goldberg. So the technique was record in frontal eye field, electrically stimulate, let's say, superior colliculus. If you can backfire the neuron, then you know it's connected and any properties. So movement and fixation cells project to the brainstem and colliculus. Visual neurons didn't so much. The study was repeated by Mark Sommer and Bob Wirtz. And Mark Sommer got different results. He saw the movement and fixation cells projecting, but he also saw the visually responsive cells projecting to the brainstem and colliculus. So in other words, the population of cells projecting to the colliculus and brainstem was the same as the total population of cells. It didn't seem differential. It's not clear to me how to reconcile the two results.
But, I mean, is there just a technical problem in backfiring?
You know, both think they knew how to do it. In fact, the studies were done in both at the LSR at NIH. I mean, it's a pretty standard technique. It may have more to do with the extensive testing of the properties of the cell that Mark Sommer did that maybe Mark Seagraves didn't.
So I have an analogy question.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this for rat, but I don't know if this is for a monkey, that there are sort of two classes of layer 5 cells, the projection neurons that we're talking about that go down to colliculus and brainstem areas. But there's also like a physically smaller cells that don't project down to the colliculus and layer 5, but actually across the callosum. Might think would be sort of visually different cells?
Maybe. Now, I don't know. I can't speak specifically to that in the monkey. I'm not recalling at the moment the colossal projection of frontal eye field. It's known. John Cost did it. I don't have a picture in my mind. The thing I would say, though, is that in both Sommer's and Seagraves' work, the latency of backfiring, in other words, the conduction latency of the axon, was shorter for movement cells than it was for fixation cells, notably shorter. And that says to me that movement cells are bigger neurons than the fixation cells. So there's probably heterogeneity in that sense too. A lot of these, I mean, it would be wonderful to know these wiring questions in more detail. It's hard information to get, but it is gettable. It's just allocating the effort to do it. All right, so there's that study, and the take-home message is two classes of cells, but also that the performance can be explained in a psychological or cognitive sense in terms of this race model, which is, you know, real simple and really absent any real architecture, but it seems to be providing kind of a constraint that would be effective for modeling from, let's say, a more bottom-up. I mean, here you know this is the performance, and the processes that give rise to the performance have certain properties. So if you want to model the circuits that give rise to that performance, you know what the end state is. Now, another experiment we've done also stresses this idea of stages of processing and is intended to explore what the... So the claim is this visual selection amounts to the perceptual stage of processing. It's identifying what is where in the image. And so if you make that discrimination more difficult, that stage should take more time. But the stage of processing, or of, you know, the stage that makes the eyes move, should occupy about the same amount of time, whether you're making the eye movement under the conditions of a hard or an easy discrimination, right? It's the same eye movement. And so in this study, so I introduce a little bit more nomenclature now. So we talk about efficient search, just meaning that the target is easily discriminable from the distractors, and green among red. Or we've now started doing search for stimuli that are moving. So you've got 8 apertures of dots moving in different directions. And if all the dots move in the same direction except this aperture, so these guys are moving right, everybody else is moving left, this is easy to find. It can be made less efficient by making the difference between the distractors and the target smaller, less salient. So green among not so green. Or in this case, make add random motion to each of the apertures. And so this is harder to find. I mean, if it's not moving in these arrows, it's impossible to find. All right? And so then reaction time increases because the search is more difficult. And it increases because of the visual properties of stimuli. We wanted this search step test provided kind of a control condition. I just remind you that he's, most of the time the target doesn't step, sometimes it does, and the monkeys are motivated to get their juice, so what they do is slow down in this task. Even on trials where there's no step, the reaction times are longer than they would have been otherwise. And that's shown here. So efficient search, no stepping, nothing, you know, just the basic. This is a cumulative distribution of the response times, of the reaction times. So 50% of the saccades are made with latencies less than, I don't know, 180 milliseconds or so. The inefficient search has longer latencies. And the blue line, we label it as response interference, are the trials where there was no step, but it was in the context of that search step task. And so the animals have slowed down to wait and see if the target's going to step, basically. But the stimulus is the same as the efficient search.
And are those just the correct trials?
No, these are just corrects. Yeah. And so now we want to lay out 2 alternative hypotheses. The time when the neuron discriminates target from distractor is something you can measure, as I was showing you before. And the suggestion is that that time represents the conclusion of the perceptual stage of processing. I mean, the brain has arrived at a representation of what is where in the image. There's nothing else to do but make the eyes move. And so we can look at the time of that discrimination and use it to partition the reaction time into 2 segments. So imagine the array comes on, the eyes move, the reaction time is of a certain amount, and this target discrimination time is of a certain value. And we can plot that target discrimination time here versus the response time here. Now here's another trial where the reaction time happens to be longer, for whatever reason. And we can measure this target discrimination time. Imagine that it's longer. The time from the discrimination to the movement is fixed, but this discrimination takes more time. We plot it like this. So you see that the increase of reaction time is proportional to the increase of the target discrimination time, the one-to-one relation. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the longer reaction time happens, but the target discrimination time is of the same value. These are two ways it could turn out. And of course, it could be anywhere in the middle as well, right? So I just want to introduce this way of plotting the data and allocating the variation of reaction time to different components identified by this stage of by this target discrimination time. So now to the data. This is all activity of one cell. Boy, these, I just made these. Can you tell these symbols? Can you see this pink and purple back there? It's pretty grim. I gotta reshoot this. Okay, well, I apologize for that. So it's, the monkey's doing motion search. Right is target, left is distractor. And so this is in the easy search, and you can see the target's discriminated from distractors after 110 milliseconds or so. And here's the plot of ROC area that you've seen before. And so how do we, you know, the time of discrimination is when the ROC area reaches 0.75. That's the criterion. Now, let's compare in the less efficient search, we're going to look at a subset of trials where the animal produced saccades with the shortest latencies. So we're going to now subsample the data according to his reaction time. We take the reaction times of the shortest third or so of the distribution, and this is the activity when the target's in the receptive field, when distractor. And based on this plot of ROC area, the target was discriminated at this time. And we can plot that value here for that reaction time. And then we look at the trials where the reaction times were of the longest, at the long end of the distribution. And that's what's shown here. And the target's discriminated at this time, like 250 milliseconds. And that's points plotted here. And what we see is that the target discrimination time and the increase of reaction time have this one-to-one relationship. So in other words, in this less efficient search condition, the longer the reaction time is longer in proportion to the length of the target discrimination time. So on some trials, the target's discriminated early and the eyes can move sooner. On other trials, for some reason, it takes longer to discriminate the target from the distractors. And so accordingly, the eyes move later. That's what's plotted here. This is just to show you that it's a visually responsive cell with no activity related to the saccade in a memory-guided situation. Okay? And this was typical of the neurons we recorded in frontal eye field. If we make this kind of plot of target discrimination time versus response time, we can quantify the fraction of the change of reaction time the fraction of the change of reaction time of target discrimination to the change of reaction time, and a one-to-one proportionality would correspond to 100%. We see that the modal value is 100%. Some are higher, some are lower. It's probably measurement noise, diversity of cells. So the message at this point is that when the search is more difficult visually, the time of target discrimination explains or accounts for the variation in reaction time. This could be the case if these cells are making the eyes move as well, right? We don't know yet whether it's the visual properties or just the fact that the eyes are moving later. So now let me give you the evidence for the dissociation. Remember, in this search step, in this response interference condition, it's always an easy search display. But now the monkey's reaction times are longer and more variable because it's being done in the context of this stepping business. And so we look at the trials with the shortest reaction times. The discrimination happens at this time. We look at the trials with the longest reaction times, and the discrimination happens at about the same time. So this plot is different from what we saw before. It's flat. And so when we put it all together, we see that in the inefficient search, when the reaction time is varying because of the visual properties of the image, this target discrimination time explains or accounts for the variation of reaction time. If the reaction time is varying because of the motor stage of processing, something to do with producing the response, then this discrimination time doesn't vary. It's linked to the properties of the image and not to the time that the eyes move. Does this make any sense at all? This approach that I just laid out here is a conventional approach in experimental psychology. It's used a lot by guys who study event-related potentials. So there's a variety of event-related potentials, and one wants to know whether they're related to the stimulus or the response. So the trick is you make reaction time vary for one reason or another, and see, does this neural measure line up on the stimulus or line up on the response?
The approach makes perfect sense, but the data is a bit less clear cut than the
clear cut meaning the breadth of the distribution, or
yeah, especially for the response interference case.
Yeah, the modal, I mean, it's not zero. It's a little higher, and there are some values that are increasing like this. So part of this, I mean, we have to allow that some of this is just measurement error, you know, depending on how many trials you get. But another part is the diversity of cells. Some cells can discriminate, and we saw this in other work before. Some cells can discriminate the target at a time that's synchronized on when the eyes move. But otherwise, they look visually responsive. So there's a heterogeneity that we haven't explained yet. We're drawing our conclusions from the mode of the distribution on this one.
There's also the fact that sometimes from the inefficient search, the time left for the response is really short. Now the sum of the cells are above.
Yeah.
So that suggests that it might be a feedback from the response even.
Well, okay, now how is that feedback?
Oh,
what's the
clearly those cells that have for which the target discrimination is after the response, they are not driving the response.
Oh no, the target discrimination is always before the eye movement. This plot is kind of the slope of this function.
But is that the common origin, the zero?
Yeah. I mean, you can't move before you've discriminated, I guess. Well,
no,
in fact, you can't. Hmm?
You are looking at one cell at a time, so some cells may enable you to discriminate if you just look at that cell after move.
Yeah, the way this is done, though, I mean, the fact is, some cells discriminate late. What that means is they don't discriminate if he moves his eyes early, but if he happens to move his eyes late, then they can express their selection. But the way this was done, we drop spikes that happen after the saccade. So we're only looking at activity before the eyes move. But to turn to another, I mean, you said there's not much time left for the eyes to move after the discrimination. And that's an important question too. I want to get to the work we've done on the process of making the eyes move. And you know, one of the questions that we want to deal with, I'm anticipating myself now. One of the questions entailed with the simultaneous recordings is to record from one of these visual selection cells and one of the movement, pre-saccadic movement cells at the same time, and see under conditions like this, when does the movement related activity begin relative to this discrimination process? Can you produce a movement before you fully process the image? Sure. It's not always in your interest, but yeah, you can emphasize speed over accuracy. But then how is that controlled? And that's another good question. Okay. Now, so now we're moving to this response preparation thing, and this is just to remind that the time when you initiate a movement is somewhat random. It's something you don't have a lot of control over. And so sprinters starting a race, of course they're motivated to get out of the blocks quickly, and this guy got out a little sooner than the rest on that race. Do you know the story of Linford Christie?
It happened too early in the record of
Well, he was disqualified. What I know is he was disqualified in the finals of the 100 meter finals in the 96 Olympics. And you understand, if you leave the blocks before the gun sounds, that's a false start. Well, he left the blocks after the gun sounded, but his reaction time was too short. So it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but it turns out at that level of competition, if you leave before 100 milliseconds, it's a false start. Because the reasoning is, if you left earlier than that, the process that made you start had to happen before the gun sounded. Right? And so he was furious and he ripped off his shirt and it was a whole, you know, big scene. And I learned also subsequently, in subsequent races, his reaction time was longer than it normally was. I mean, he was losing races because he was getting careful. Now obviously he didn't want to leave the blocks prematurely, you know, but this just stresses the point that the precise time when you make a movement is something you, as an agent, don't have a lot of control over. So it's an interesting question. And where does that variability come from? It amounts to the problem of reaction time. So this is just something from some of our data. We could produce it anytime you want. You put somebody in a situation, you know, hit a button, move your eyes, speak, whatever. Same stimulus, produce the movement, measure the interval, and do it 100 or 1,000 times, and you get a range of response times. Sometimes it's early, sometimes it's late, usually it's somewhere in the middle. And the challenge is to understand this reaction time, its duration and its variability. Because if you add up, like in the Saccade system, if you add up the time it takes for light to get into the brain, you know, retina, 30 milliseconds, you know, maybe let's say 50, 60 milliseconds, and then you measure the amount of time it really takes to make the eyes move, like you electrically stimulate frontal eye field or superior colliculus, and the eyes move in 30 milliseconds. So, you know, 50, say, plus 30 equals 80. And in fact, monkeys can make saccades reliably with 80 millisecond reaction times, 80 millisecond latencies, but they have to be in a very special condition. It's referred to as express saccades, right? So they have to know when the light and the fixed spot's off and very reliable. And you can do it. But in sort of like, say, normal conditions, you don't. Why not? And so, like Roger Carpenter at Cambridge has used the phrase that the brain procrastinates. So we were interested in that, and experimental psychologists have been working on this for some time and have developed, you know, numerous models of reaction time, some of which are applicable to neuroscience, many of which aren't, and they don't even care to be. But one class of model that seems relevant holds that there is an accumulator, some process that accumulates information. Light comes on, it accumulates, and when it reaches a threshold, a movement is produced. All right? So you got an accumulator reaching a threshold, a movement is produced. Somewhere, a stochastic element needs to be built in to explain the randomness of the reaction time. And so one class or one version of these models supposes that the threshold is fixed. And what varies randomly from trial to trial is the rate of growth of this accumulator. Sometimes it ramps up quickly and other times it ramps up slowly. And if it ramps up quickly, it reaches its threshold sooner, so the movement is produced earlier. If it ramps up slower, it reaches the threshold later and the movement is produced later. So that's one version of it, and it makes predictions that are consistent with behavioral data. Another version holds that the accumulator is a fixed process and the threshold is variable. Sometimes it may have a low value, so it's reached sooner and the movement's produced earlier. Sometimes it has a higher threshold, which takes longer to reach, and the movements produced later. And this model makes predictions that behavioral data are consistent with. And in fact, I mean, you can imagine a hybrid, of course, and in fact, some mathematical work has shown that these two models make equivalent predictions. You can't decide between them based on behavioral data. So our view was, you know, what's going on in the black box? You have to open it and look. And so that's what we claim to have done. The idea is, if you could measure this accumulator, you could decide between these alternatives. One way is measure the level of the accumulator at the point in time when the movement's triggered. Measure this threshold level. And so threshold activation as a function of reaction time, if it's flat, that's consistent with this variable rate fixed threshold. On the other hand, if it's increasing, then it's consistent with this variable threshold model, right? And you can make the same measurements on the rate of growth for the variable rate. The rate of growth has got to be higher on shorter reaction time trials and decrease as reaction time increases. On the other hand, if the accumulator is fixed, then you measure some property, some rate constant for it, it's going to not vary with reaction time. So we've got alternative predictions based on these two hypotheses. Yeah?
I don't understand something here. So you're sort of operating on the assumption that whenever you're recording something, you're recording the green thing, not the yellow thing. But the yellow thing has to come from somewhere as well. And that could be firing rate two of someone else. And you could be recording that instead. So what?
Yes. Well, let me say to you what you just said to me in the way that we've talked about it. So to make this claim entails what we call or what's known as a linking proposition. And there's this wonderful paper by DeVita Teller many years ago now. And the question is, you know, the goal of neuroscience, really cognitive neuroscience, is to generate statements that have, you know, the word mind and the word brain and some, you know, verb is in there and have it mean something. And so so she talks about these as linking propositions. And so the claim here is, if we're monitoring neural activity, it assumes that it is the well, another component of that is the idea of a bridge locus. A linking proposition is true at the bridge locus. There's certain neurons that for which it's true, and others for which it's not true, because they're in the olfactory system or something, right? You know, they're just not relevant. And so you're right. I'll show you this data, and then we have to explore, is it appropriate to call these neurons the accumulator? And there's actually it's an issue that's fun to talk about. Now, on the other question of how do you instantiate a threshold? Well, that's something I'd love to hear your thoughts about after I show you this data. Because, you know, you record a neuron, you get action potentials. That's what you get. Right. And then we start telling stories. And how a threshold is produced is something I don't know is that clear.
So at this point, I should think about the neurons you report from as the green lines, because they tend to accumulate.
Well, I'll show you, and then I'll entice you to believe that. Yeah. Was there, yeah.
So are you talking about variability of reaction time from trial to trial? Or
yeah.
Talking about from condition to condition?
Trial to trial, matched condition, same condition.
So how about having the same slope, but they just have different noise? Why do you have to have different slopes?
Well, let me show you the data, and then, I mean, this was a cartoon we made just to lay out the alternatives. The premise of the model is it just happens. There's a
stoke.
Yeah. 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 Well, where it comes from. Yeah. Yes, which amounts to a different mean slope.
Yeah.
Yeah. let me show you the data, and then this is just right. So, so the claim here is the movement cells in frontal eye field, and it's probably going to hold true in the other parts of the brain where there are these things. The movement cells are the accumulator of interest for this question. All right, so here is the activity of a movement cell in frontal eye field, and there are 150 trials here. The tick marks are, you know, vanishingly small now, and the data, so the blue line is the average firing rate, and we're aligned on the time of the saccade at zero, and the data are plotted chronologically. So the first trial's on the bottom, the last trial's on the top. These green bars show the time when the target came on. And so you can see the range and the variability of reaction time. If I show you the first 50 trials, and we're going to bet on what the reaction time on the next trial is going to be within, I don't know, 5 milliseconds or so, you know, you wouldn't make a lot of money. And so you got the growth, and then, okay, and so then the approach was what I've already alluded to before. Sample the data according to the reaction time that was produced. So here are a subset of these trials where the latency was between 225 and 250 milliseconds. And we can ask, what was the level of activity at the point in time when the movement was triggered? And so there's the oculomotor system. We know events that happen in the brainstem, so that within about between 10 and 20 milliseconds before the saccade, the point of no return has been crossed. You know, at that point, the eyes are going to move. So we can measure the activity at that time. For this set of trials, it was 99 spikes per second. This is the subset of trials with longer reaction times, 300 to 325. The level of activity at the point in time when the saccade was triggered was 97 spikes per second. And this plots for sampling throughout the reaction time distribution, the activity level when the movement was triggered as a function of reaction time, and there's no regression there. Looks like the fixed threshold. And then we can measure the rate of growth, and as you see on trials with the shortest latencies, the rate of growth is of a is higher rate than on trials with the longer latency, and there is a significant regression here. So this is a representative of the cells in frontal eye field that all look like the fixed threshold random rate of growth model. And effectively, none of the cells in frontal eye field looked like the fixed rate random threshold appearance. So that's the observation. Let me do two more things, and then it'll be fun to return to this question. Is it legitimate to identify these neurons with this accumulator? So one of the things that, I mean, this was done by a graduate student named Doug Haynes. One of the things he thought was, you know, this model, or the version of the model that we were familiar with at the time, was developed by Roger Carpenter. It's just trivial. You've got a fixed rate of growth. You know, it's linear. And it has a slope that's drawn from a Gaussian distribution, certain mean and standard deviation. And it hits a threshold, which is a fixed value. And then there's also can be a delay to when you start to accumulate the activity. And so the delay is, well, and then, you know, and you can make up a spreadsheet, for crying out loud, to simulate this. And so what Doug thought was, you know, I can measure the threshold by averaging across these values drawn from a single cell. And, you know, I've got a range of rates of growth. I can calculate the mean and standard deviation. You know, it's not going to be that reliable an estimate, but it's what you can do. And just plug those numbers in. So, and then, you know, we can measure this latency till the activity starts growing as well. And so the latency is fixed, the threshold is fixed. And what varies is this rate of growth. You can draw from a random distribution. And so what Doug did was look at the reaction time distribution that the monkey's brain produced and create a distribution of reaction times using parameters from single cells And this is what he got. So we're plotting the means of the simulated reaction time as a function of the actual reaction time, and there's real good agreement, one outlier, and this is a guy that had few trials, so probably the mean of the actual mean may not have been very reliable. And this is a plot of the difference and so on. So there's a nice agreement in the mean reaction time produced by the monkey's brain and the mean reaction time predicted by the activity of a single cell. And in fact, it's like 20% of them or so, the whole shape of the distribution was the same. And so this is the picture that we hold in our minds anyway when we think about how a response is prepared. There's this class of cells that may or may not have a visual response, but the activity can grow at different rates. And where that variability comes from is not clear. But if it happens to grow quickly, the eyes move earlier. If it happens to grow later, the eyes move later. All right? And so, to come back to this question, how would a movement get produced earlier than the selection allowed? Well, you just activate these guys prematurely. So, now, but then the other question, are we measuring the accumulator or are we measuring the threshold? And I'm interested what you think this looks like.
I mean, where do you think this comes from? This comes from this uncorrelated noise source, the frontal atrials. I mean, there's no obvious predict, like you had lots of previous activity of the eyes. Does that actually influence the rate at which?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't seem to. This rate, the stimuli are the same. All the conditions are the same. And yet sometimes it's...
No, but is the monkey's eyes actually doing different things? If I look back more than 100 milliseconds...
Yeah.
If I look back before that 0 point, right?
Yeah, he's just fixating in the center. I mean, as far as we can experimentally control, the conditions are identical.
And what about sort of the issue of the reflections of microcytops in the frontal eye field? I started asking if there's something about the activity of these neurons.
Yeah.
Such that maybe I'm thinking very biophysical terms, like their impedance was about different states, so therefore they're charging.
Right.
For their firing rate.
Well, there must be a biophysical explanation for this, obviously, because it happened in the way it happened. So, on the question of microcircads, we don't know. We haven't looked yet. I mean, that's a good question that's come up before, and we just haven't got to it. What the kind of biophysical underpinnings of this are is something I'm interested in getting your opinions about. I mean, these are imagine these as pyramidal cells in layer 5, which are getting input from everybody.
Did you measure the field potential at the same time so that you'd be able to see if there's some
correlation? We're getting set to do that. We just got a new Harvey box that'll let us do that. Yeah.
I just wonder how sure are you this really looks like a meaning. Not exponential or something. It probably depends on how you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Start with just single spike can.
Well, okay, on that question, these spike density functions constructed the way that we do it for small sets of trials, probably 5 or something like that, 5 or 10, each of those. I mean, this is kind of just a cartoon we made to make the point, but it is from real data. Now, in the early work, we just did linear regression of these spike density functions, and the Durbin-Watson test to look at the autocorrelation across to see if you could reject a line as a good fit. And for many of the cells in that set of data, you couldn't say a line wasn't as good a fit as anything you could do. But we haven't pushed aggressively other fits just because to say it's exponential means... I mean, it can't be exponential in its totality because it does stop and then roll over. You know, there's got to be some other process involved as well. And it certainly doesn't look like a negatively accelerating exponential. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. 1 minus.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't look that way. I mean, we haven't done quantitative fits about it, but yeah.
So I think I got the study for these saccade related cells, and I got the other study for the discriminate for the saccade should go. It depends on whether it goes there or not.
Yeah.
What I wonder now is whether there is any relation between the activation of the first group of cells and this rate of growth.
Yeah, great question, and we're just in the process of getting the data. It has to, you know, to do it right, we got to have recordings from both kinds of cells at the same time. And Chen Chao Rao started doing that. We had a bunch of data. He was unhappy with how it was going and went and got a job programming computers. So we're at a kind of a low state on that right now. I'll let you know.
Is there anything about how engine would have this kind of thing? Some trials among the room of boards and other trials smaller birds?
It could be. Now, there's, you know, we know how to do experiments to get at that, and we just haven't got at it yet. But yeah, attention may be a factor in this as well. But the question is, what do you mean by attention? If attention means kind of this selection and visual processing kind of thing, then it kind of comes back to this, which they say we're trying to get to. If attention means a quicker reaction time in a Posner sense, then it surely would affect this. But whether it affects it, I mean, there's other work in like superior colliculus from Doug Munoz's lab, where in this case, the monkeys are going to make an eye movement with equal probability in either direction. If you change the probability so that they go this way more often than that way, then the reaction times are reduced. And they found that this baseline activity can vary according to the propensity to make a movement in or out of the receptive field. And it's an easy step. I mean, there's no paper in the literature that's done this completely yet. But it's an easy step to say, if you're closer to the threshold, then you're going to get there quicker, you know, and show it physiologically. Roger Carpenter's produced data consistent with that behaviorally in his modeling work, but we don't have the physiology yet.
Not detected any gross shifts in the course of the experiment.
No, we looked for that. I mean, the monkeys, they get satiated, they start, you know, I mean, at the end they quit performing as well as they were at the beginning. But when we looked for that kind of trend in this, we haven't seen much. It's worth more investigation, though. The problem is the data get thin fast. Okay, well, we've pushed this idea around in another way. Oh, well, I forgot this, right. So, I mean, this is just to fill in this idea, so that we've got the selection neurons, and those are instantiating some kind of perceptual stage of processing, or at least indexing the outcome of it and the conclusion. And then this movement activity is the response stage, and there's interesting questions to ask about how this time relates to this time, and as I said, we're in the process of that. Now, to evaluate this question, what these neurons are doing in more detail, let me introduce this countermanding task. And so, actually, all right.
Stop
problem. Keep going. All right. I mean, this is either the last segment or there's one more after if you're interested. But so the data I've showed you so far in this reaction time story has all been collected in this countermanding task. So it's like what you saw before, although now he fixates, a target appears, single target, no search, and he shifts gaze after a certain reaction time. That's the most common trial. The random unexpected trial has him fixate, the target appears, and while he's preparing the movement, or let's see, during the reaction time, the fixation spot comes back on. And that is a stop signal. So in other words, if he cancels the movement, he gets reinforced. If he fails to cancel the movement, he doesn't get reinforced. And the probability of canceling or not canceling is again a function of the stop signal delay. So this shows the behavior of a couple of monkeys doing this. Now we're implying the probability that he makes a saccade given that there was a stop signal. Oh my, a stop signal. I've shown this slide I don't know how many years and I just noticed that. I'm sorry. So increasing probability with the delay, right? It's not hard to understand. And the way that so it's a nice task, and it's been used for, you know, probably 50 years to study, human performance. But Gordon Logan, a cognitive psychologist, developed a race model to explain the behavior, and we thought that gave us some interesting leverage on the properties of neurons. So here's how it works. You've got the plot of probability of responding, and the model is like we saw before. Now it's just a race between the process that makes you go and a process that makes you stop. Whichever one finishes first, that's what you do. And the procedure then, the idea is that the distribution of reaction times is the universe of possibility, and that the fraction of trials that you are able, the fraction of trials where a movement is produced correspond to the fraction of the shortest reaction times in the reaction time distribution, right? And so one can integrate this distribution up to the value of the given by the fraction of being inhibited, and the time at which you've reached that fraction is the time at which the stop signal began being effective. So that these guys are the trials that would be canceled if the stop signal had appeared. All right? And on basis of that, one can estimate the reaction time to the stop signal, how long it takes to cancel the movement. And it is, in these data, on average about 100 milliseconds. All right. So again, this stopping is a covert process. You don't see it happening. All you see is the eyes not moving. But through this model, this formulation that Logan and his co-workers have developed, it gains a legitimacy as a time at which a key events happen in the brain. And so we were interested to see if neurons modulated in that interval. Now the idea was, you can look at it as I'm telling you this. The idea was you want to find neurons that are in control of behavior. Which neurons dictate whether or not the movement is produced. And so for the criteria for those neurons are that in the first place, they should fire differently if a movement is produced versus not being produced. That hopefully is obvious. But the other criterion is, in this context, the modulation must happen before the stop signal reaction time. Otherwise, it's too late. And so this top panel shows the activity of a movement cell in frontal eye field. That's better. And the blue line plots the activity on trials where there was no stop signal. So it's just growing to the threshold to make the eye movement. And the yellow line plots the activity on trials when the stop signal appeared and the movement was canceled. So you see the same, this one happened to have a little visual response, the activity growing. At this point in time, the stop signal comes on, the activity is still growing, it takes time for the signal to get in there, and then the bottom falls out. The activity just stops. And the eyes don't move. Furthermore, the time, you can see when the activity became different for this cell, and we can write the stop signal reaction time here. I want to emphasize that that arrow, that time, was estimated from the behavioral data of the monkey while this neuron was recorded. So we get the what's called the inhibition function, you get the reaction time distribution, run the procedure, and get a stop signal reaction time. And we were struck by the correspondence in time between this estimate from the behavior data and the time of modulation of the neurons. That's a movement neuron. This is a fixation neuron. Remember, these guys fire during fixation and their activity goes down until the eyes move. Then they may or may not turn back on. And on trials where the movement was canceled, the activity goes down, and then you see this rapid growth of activity immediately before the stop signal reaction time. And so the claim, the conclusion we draw is that these neurons in frontal eye field fire or modulate in a way sufficient to control gaze. Not every neuron in frontal eye field did. The visual neurons that I told the whole search story about, commonly they didn't modulate under these conditions. Because remember, the target's still on. So many of them, in fact, I think most, just, you know, the light came on, they fired, and they kept firing whether or not he moved. So it's a subset of cells that generate these specific kinds of signals. In fact, coming back to this threshold question, we can plot from the behavioral data the probability that he fails to cancel, and that's shown in white. We can also ask, what's the probability that the activity exceeds some threshold as a function of the stop signal delay? Now, what do you mean by activity and what do you mean by threshold are interesting questions, and there's no unique answer. So there's an area to explore. In this case, we just said threshold was a fixed value, one number, and activity was just the firing rate from this spike density function. And it turns out for these neurons in frontal eye field, you can find one value. In this case, it was 100 for this cell, 120 spikes per second. And the probability of the activity exceeding that threshold creates a plot that corresponds to the performance of the animal. We don't want to say this neuron was the only one that made him behave in this way. Thousands or hundreds of thousands or more probably did, but it's it. What we're struck by, and this is another question that would be interesting to discuss with you, is, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of a paradox. On the one hand, you know that, you know, thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of neurons are necessary to produce a movement, but I'm showing you data that indicates that one or, you know, no more than 10 is sufficient to account for the production of the movement. So it must be there's a high degree of coordination or correlation among this large pool of neurons.
But maybe that gets back to your previous point about the rate of climb that's highly correlated with noise.
Yeah. Yeah. But you see, okay, so I guess I don't have a deep enough understanding of what that means.
And, I mean, they're all doing the same thing, so averaging doesn't help you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so then this is a segue into another whole other line of work, and so I leave it to your judgment. What happens when they make errors? So in this countermanding task, they're supposed to cancel the movement. Sometimes, you know, often they don't. We create the conditions where they can't. And so this shows the activity of a movement neuron, and the yellow shows trials where I forget, they're not different, so I forget which is the yellow and which is the green. One is when there's no stop signal, and the other is when there's a stop signal, but they ignore it. They make a movement inadvertently. And there's no difference of activity in frontal eye field. They just make the eyes move. Now, there's this, we've done recordings in another part of the brain called the supplementary eye field, in which there's a whole other story to tell. But I'm happy to just quit now and tell it informally later, or... It wouldn't hurt my feelings to sit down and quit for a second.
Okay, why don't we just meet, we won't go to lunch now. But,